This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi, I'm Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. I hope you're well wherever you are listening from, and a really interesting bunch of guests for you today. We were in conversation with Dr. Hannah Rolls, a self-confessed foster fail. She's got a new dog and wants to talk about why it's so important to adopt, not shop. She was on hand to take your questions too, as ever. And as my trip to Kilimanjaro ticks ever closer, we rounded up the experts who can inspire you to take on a challenge. Like Caroline Leon, who suffered a terrible injury in 2015, 23 blood transfusions, countless surgeries. Well, she's back, she's climbing mountains, and she's leading us on that expedition. So what can we expect? And if you feel like you couldn't put your hiking boots on and take to the trails, whether here in the UAE or internationally, Sean Burgess, Challenge Director at Goal for Good, was on hand to talk about the upcoming calendar. And in light of the recent announcements, we've heard out of the UK that vaccination certificates from the UAE are now accepted. We had Nathan Taylor joining us from Donata Travel to explain a little bit more about the truth behind the headlines and offer up a pretty spectacular travel deal too. And marking World Zero Emissions Day with not one, but two experts who can help you, well, hopefully get to zero one day. Don't forget, you can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5 UAE time.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the animal before the owner.
And I want to know this afternoon, what would you ask your pet if they could talk? I would love to hear what accent my dog has. I feel like an Irish brogue, but genuinely, I really hope my husband's not listening. I want to know who's the favourite, me or my husband, because I think we both suspect that we are the favourite. I think it's really me. So Jarvis, if you're listening, blink once for me, twice for Dad. What would you ask your pet? Leo wants to know, why do you never finish your food? Maya wants to know from her pet, why did you choose me to be your fur mom? I'm guessing that's one of those where the cat adopts you rather than the other way around. Sandripi wants to know, what can I do to make you less grumpy? And Ollie, I feel your pain. Can you please not ruin my stuff? Dr. Hannah Rolls is here from the St. Vincent Group joining us live on Microsoft Teams. How are you, Dr. Hannah?
I am very well, thank you.
So what I want to know, what do you want to know from your pets? What question would you ask them?
I would love to know what my cat has to say every day, because an awful lot. He just bursts through the cat flap, normally around a mealtime, and just sort of, it sounds like he's got so much to tell us, and I would really love to know what it is, whether it's who he's met, where he's been, you know, what he's been up to, what trouble he's got in, I don't know.
But tall tales.
Always a lot.
We should note that tomorrow, the 23rd of September, is Remember Me Thursday. This is an International Social Media Awareness Day, bringing attention to the millions of adoptable pets ready, waiting in shelters, and remembers those pets who never got a second chance. Dr. Hannah, you've got a new addition to the family. You've adopted a dog.
I do.
A boy or
yes,
girl?
Well, we haven't finished a girl. We haven't finished her formal adoption. We're fostering her at the moment, but we will do. She's a foster fail, definitely.
What's her name?
Audrey.
Oh, she's so sophisticated, Audrey. I love it. What's her story?
To my knowledge, anyway, she was just found wandering the streets in Abu Dhabi and was picked up by House of Hounds, the adoption sort of rescue service there. And she was being fostered by a friend of ours who I think decided that she would be perfect in a family setting and decided that we would be a good family. So managed to convince us to look after her for the weekend over the summer.
there you
and
go.
And then another weekend.
Hook,
and
line,
then
and sinker.
Take her for a week. Yes, exactly. And she's fitted in really well. She's lovely. So that's her story.
I love it. I love it. And I think fostering is such a valuable way of getting an understanding if an animal could fit into your life and that particular animal as well. And there's lots of as you say, organisations who are looking for some help, some support right now. So any questions about adopting, please do get in touch, 4001. Dr. Hannah, in your experience, whether that is professionally or anecdotally, what do you think is stopping a lot of people from adopting, many people still buying?
I think probably as a vet, when you hear the reasons that people use or that they talk about, and often it's the fact that they want a particular breed. that's probably a big reason. And whether that's because they think that, for example, they're hypoallergenic, I hear that all the time. And really, no dog breed is hypoallergenic. So I think that's a bit of a myth that's come about. And if you do have your heart set on a certain pedigree breed, then you know you're going to have to source that puppy or kitten that way. Mm-hmm. But the majority of people, I think, especially sort of first-time pet owners, don't know what they want. And I always think that with rescuing and with fostering, you have the ability of being able to really get to know the animal. When you pick up a puppy or kitten, you know, straight from the litter, you don't know anything about their personality or you know how they're gonna grow up. But when you rescue an animal, you can have a really good idea from the people that are fostering or from the people that have found them, you know, what their story is, what their personality is. And often you'll see them being sort of, when you see their little rescue profile, you can see that they've said, you know, a home with other dogs would be great, or a home with children would be perfect. So, you know, you'll sort of have a much more educated idea going into it when you foster or adopt.
Well said indeed.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
And I want to know from you this afternoon, if your pet could talk, what would you ask them? Dr. Hannah is with us from the St. Vincent Group. Dr. Hannah, going to the text line. Liza saying, why does my cat insist I watch him eat? Just that, really. Our older cat died a few months ago, and when they were alive, they literally ignored each other 99% of the time, and the rest would fight. Now he'll only eat if one of us is stood behind him. If we walk off, he stops eating and follow us. What has got into him? Any ideas? Do you think he needs a new companion?
I think when it comes to cats, grief can display itself in many different ways. And it could well be that he's feeling a bit wobbly, even though it didn't ostensibly look like he got on with his companion. The fact that he's now on his own might make him feel a little bit more insecure and a little bit more vulnerable. Normally, I think these things settle down with time. I know when we first bought our cat home, he wouldn't use his litter tray unless we were in the apartment. And so I'd get home from work and he would sort of eyeball me and then run into the bathroom where the litter tray was. And I was like, why is he doing that? I'm really worried that he would give himself, you know, a urinary tract infection or we'd start having problems. But that settled down. So sometimes I think it's just a way of making themselves feel safer and more secure if you're there while he eats. So I wouldn't worry about it unduly. I would just keep the routine as much as you can. Be there when he wants to eat his dinner and make sure he finishes it all. And I hope that it would settle down. As far as looking for a companion for him, I would wait until that sort of behavior has settled down and think really carefully, because we know that cats are not, you know, they're not pack animals. They don't seek out the comfort and the company of other cats necessarily. That's quite unusual. And a totally different individual will that the dynamics between the two of them could take some time to settle down, and it might upset him all over again. So I would be patient, and then, you know, if you feel like you'd like to get a companion for your whole family, then talk to your vet about the best ways to sort of ease that transition, because it can be a little bit difficult sometimes.
Okay, thinking of you guys, lots of people getting in touch with questions this afternoon, and it tends to be a bit of a cat focus today. Thank you, Joe, saying my white cat Pandora, oh my goodness, if I ever had another kid, Pandora would be on the list, is having hiccups. Sounds like a hiccup sound. Should I be worried? She's hiding from me, so I know where to find her, because she's always having that sound and I'm worried she's got a health problem. So a kitty with hiccups. I can't think of anything cuter, but is this cause for concern, Hannah?
Not necessarily, but I would go and see the vet. Hiccups are relatively rare, and I'd just be a little bit worried that maybe she was trying to bring up a hairball or something like that. But I would just recommend a vet check. As long as she's not vomiting with it, I probably wouldn't be panicked. You know, as long as she's swallowing well, she's able to drink her water and eat her food. But if she's hiding from you as well, that always makes me a bit suspicious that they're not as happy as I would like. So a vet check would probably be a really good idea.
Okay, hope that helps. Loving your messages and what you'd ask your pets. I genuinely want to know if Jarvis, our spaniel, prefers me or my husband. I think it's me. I do. I'm going to we'll need to figure out a way of him communicating with us. Gency wants to ask Lulu if she loves me back. And love this. I'd ask my foster dog, Wallace, because he was a bit of a wally. What did he need us to do to help him? He's 5 months old. He's so frightened of some people, but is so affectionate with the kids and good with other pets, from Gillian. Maybe that's something you could help with, Dr. Doolittle, this afternoon, Hannah. So 5-month-old foster dog. What do we know about why, you know, he's obviously very comfortable with the kids and happy in the family home, but is really fearful of some other people?
I mean, if he's 5 months old, they don't know what happened to him when he was teeny tiny, if they've only recently rescued him. And this is just from personal observation with Audrey as well, is she behaves very differently around my children than she does with me and other adults. I think they sense that there's not much to fear, especially with small children. And they do, she seems to adapt her behavior as well. She's less bouncy with them, you know, because they're much smaller, and she's just a bit gentler around them. So I don't necessarily think that's unusual. And I think it's lovely to notice. What you can do, I think, with adults is that there's a lot of ways that you can, when he's approaching strangers, is to have it on neutral ground, not necessarily have a stranger enter what he thinks is his home and his safe space. So maybe greet them outside, if you've got a yard or a garden, and let the puppy meet them first. Make sure everybody greets him, puts a hand out first, and a hand sort of underneath his chin, if that makes sense, aim for underneath his chin, because even if we think that it's friendly to go above their head to stroke them, that can be quite a intimidating gesture, especially if, you know, there's been sort of any history that we don't know about. They might be frightened by an arm over their head. So there's a few things that we can do, and it's always worth having a chat with your vet. If they're frightened of the vet, you can maybe increase the visits and just go and walk around the waiting room and then go home rather than go in to see the vet. But it's always a good way of meeting the nurses and meeting lots of different people. Socialization is the key, and it will be a bit difficult, but it will get better with time.
It's worth it.
Positive experiences count.
Yeah, it's worth it for Wally, Gillian. Wishing you guys all the very best there. And I want to know, if you could talk to your pet and they could talk back, what would you ask them? Finn wants to ask her cat, Tilly Willy Daydream, why do you purr and lift up a front leg when you want to be stroked and kissed? Lisa wants to know, what would your dream job be as a cat?
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the animal before the owner.
If your pet could talk, what would you ask them? Don just simply wants to know, is Coco, are you happy in our home? Oh, I'm sure she is. Dr. Hannah Rolls is on hand to tackle your questions in real time as you come in on 4001 or on the ARN Play app. Message here from Russell saying, hi Helen, I have a cat. I was able to have a spayed 2 months ago, but now the in-heat symptoms are back. Meowing overnight, running around and in distress. I'm sure she's back in heat again. What should I do? Dr. Hannah, is this possible?
It shouldn't be, no. That shouldn't be the problem at all. If she's been spayed, she'll have had her ovaries removed, which means that the estrogen stimulation and the drive for coming into season isn't there anymore. So I would, those behaviours worry me a little bit that she's uncomfortable somehow. So I would say that go back to the vets if you can. If it's not happening all the time, so it's not, you know, it's predominantly at night and not during the day. Video phones have made life so much easier for us, really. See if you can get a video of what she's doing, exactly what her behaviour is. Sometimes with cats, it's difficult to know if vocalisation is a vocalisation because she wants to tell you something, or she's sort of, it's a behaviour, or whether it means that she's uncomfortable in some way. Mm. So if you can get a video, that really, really helps always for us to have a look and see what we think might be going on. But that's where I would start and go back to the vet, particularly if it's a consistent behaviour that's happening, sort of, it's been going on sort of 2 or 3 days and longer, then I'd say we need to see what's going on and
okay.
Have a check.
Really hope that helps, Russell. Do keep us posted on that. And Shane has been in touch on 4001 saying, my cat has lost a lot of weight in the span of 3 months. She's also really sluggish and doesn't react when I cuddle her. What do you think could be wrong? Oh, Shayna. Dr. Hannah, does that ring any alarm bells? It sounds like definitely a time to go to the vets, but what could Shayna experience in terms of questions asked and any other symptoms that might have gone unnoticed?
if she has lost weight, what I would be worried about is if her appetite has decreased. You know, is she eating physically less food than she used to? And that would be why she's losing weight. And they can do that for a number of reasons. If she's feeling nauseous, she won't eat as much. Sometimes it can be down to dental disease. If she has a sore tooth and it's very difficult for her to eat dry food, she might decrease the amount she's eating. And what we might see is the weight loss. Alternatively, sometimes there'll be some hormonal conditions, some endocrine conditions that adjust your metabolic rate. So it could be that she's eating normally, but her metabolic rate's increased, and that's why she's losing weight. So a few observations from the owner's point of view as to whether the diet has changed, whether the amount that's going in the cat has decreased, whether there's any gastrointestinal symptoms, whether they are vomiting more frequently than, you know, than normal, because some cats do, you know, have hairballs and problems like that. But that if that is increased, that means that she's not consuming as much as she used to. Has there been any diarrhea? Has there been any reason why she might be stressed? All of those things to think about before you go in, because they're really useful when we're trying to take a history. If you've changed the diet, anything like that. If she's on any other medication, whether that's been difficult to get in, all of these things can be really, really important. But definitely, if it's weight loss you've noticed as well, particularly if she's a fluffy cat, then I'd be worried that she's lost quite a bit by the time we can sort of see it from the outside. So she definitely needs to visit a vet very soon.
Thank you, Dr. Hannah. The message from Elisa here saying, is organic coconut oil a treatment for ringworm or bites instead of traditional medicine like Caniston? Someone suggested using apple cider vinegar as well. The kitty has a patch on her head, and another issue is do these transfer to her newborns? So ringworm or mites, are these two separate conditions, Dr. Hannah, or can they be treated in much the same way?
No, ringworm and mites are two separate conditions. So ringworm is actually caused by a fungus, not a worm. It's a bit of a, poorly named condition. And the important thing about ringworm is that it is very infectious. So it's infectious to other cats, and it's infectious to people as well. I wouldn't recommend treating with either apple cider vinegar or coconut oil. You really need to use a medication to deal with the fungus, for sure. And mites, again, are the same. So mites are tiny little insects that bury into the skin and can be very, very itchy. But again, those need a course, a prescription, it's sort of a medication, and they need to be monitored by a vet to get rid of. Apple cider vinegar and coconut oil won't do it. And I know everyone loves those kind of sort of remedies or things that go around the internet, but there really is a reason why your vet spent years at vet school and why these medications exist. It's because this is a condition that needs treatment from a vet. If coconut oil was that wonderful and that all kind of
cure,
we'd never need to see that. It's a cure for everything, isn't it?
It's a cure for dry skin, but that's probably about it for us, our human shins. Okay,
exactly.
Hope that helps there. And I think that's just a really good reminder. And let's turn our attentions to food now, because Queenie's been in touch saying, my dog Sam eats what I eat, and my friends say that's not good. Chicken, fish, salads and bread mostly. He is slightly overweight but really active. What do I do? He dislikes pet food. And we've got no idea how old or what breed Sam is, but can you give some general guidelines for Queenie and anyone else out there who is dabbling or thinking about non-specific, food that's not designed for animals?
Okay, so I take a deep breath here. It is important to remember that although we're both mammals, dogs and humans have very different digestive anatomy and digestive physiology. So their metabolism works very differently to ours. For example, we tend to get the most of our energy from carbohydrate sources, whereas our dogs and our cats in particular are not as good at getting energy from carbohydrates. They need a higher protein level than we do, and in a lot of circumstances, a higher fat level. So that will be one way that we differ. Also, we have different what we call essential nutrients, so things that our dog and cat need to get from their diet compared to what we need to get from our diet. And it is very, very difficult to balance that appropriately with a home cooked diet or a home prepared diet, especially if you are not a veterinary nutritionist. It's difficult to know the sources that you need to make sure that the nutrients are available to the animal, so they're digestible and they're balanced as well. So as far as switching your dog, if he's been fed mainly a diet like this, switching him onto a kibble, is we would say go do it gradually. And a lot of the time, to sort of tempt them to try to eat the kibble, we would put a topper on. And that topper can be a little bit of chicken and it can be a little bit of fish, something that he's had before, that would tempt him into the bowl, and then less and less of that and more of the kibble. And the other thing would be stay strong, because they're very good at holding out when they think that there's something more palatable and more like a treat that they want to get. But in the same way that we don't eat McDonald's every day, it's not good for our cats and dogs to be eating treat food, in inverted commas, every day. They need to have the right maintenance food. And that is, in my opinion, a pet kibble that's been prepared by a company that are using veterinary nutritionists and board certified nutritionists to formulate them.
I think it's you're giving me like flashbacks of dealing with my picky eating child, going a little bit of this and make sure you stay strong, but also presumably waiting until they're hungry, feeding them. The timing must be an interesting point as well.
Yes, definitely. And I promise that they will eat when they're hungry. So, and sometimes I've heard when we've been trying to switch onto a diet, or switch over from a home cooked diet to a kibble based diet, and bear in mind there are wet foods as well, wet foods that are prepared and for dogs and cats. So you can always use that to mix in as well. It depends what is convenient for you and what you want to feed, your pet. But they will eat when they're hungry. I promise you, they won't starve themselves to death on account of really not liking that kibble. They will eat eventually. It's just a case of who breaks first sometimes. So you have to be strong.
Dr. Hannah with us this afternoon. Great message from Sol here. Something that hadn't really occurred to me. Sol saying, my mother-in-law is allergic to guinea pigs and cats. Does pet fur travel around the house? She comes over often. Don't want her to be uncomfortable. If we get guinea pigs, we wouldn't have them in the lounge, but in my home office, but they're adjacent rooms, and I'm just worried about the fur travelling and having an impact. Good question, and a very considerate I like it. So what do we know about, you mentioned hypoallergenic there earlier, what about allergy to things like guinea pig or cat fur and it travelling around the home to a point where it could perhaps give a human a reaction?
Yes, they're very right to be concerned, because unfortunately we do know that with any animal, when we're allergic to them, we tend to be allergic to their hair, but also to their saliva and to the dander or the skin cells that they deposit, that we all deposit in our environment. And we do know, unfortunately, that will stick to clothing, that will stick to people, and that, so it can be transferred, quite a long way from where the animal actually resides. What I would suggest is that your mother-in-law could, I would say at first, let's see how you get on using things like sticky rolls to make sure that you've sticky rolled yourself and tried to remove any of that debris that might be on anyone who's handled the guinea pigs. Use a Hoover to pick up some of that debris as well. And if your mother-in-law is seriously allergic, it might be worth her speaking to her doctor or pharmacist and see if there's any antihistamine she can take in preparation for the visit, to make sure that, to see how she reacts and to sort of cover all your bases. Sticky rolls, Hoover, and then sort of even removing clothes, the outer sort of layer of clothes that people who've been in contact with the guinea pigs have been wearing, and change their clothes, wash hands, all those kind of things will significantly limit the amount of allergen that's transferring through your house.
There you go. I hope that helps. Yeah, I know I'm hungry because you said sticky rolls and I'm just thinking, that sounds delicious.
I like sticky ones.
Right. Last question of the day. A really interesting one from Lee saying, my pal says he's a trained pet first aider. Is that a real thing or is he pulling my leg? I don't know.
Good question.
Can you be a pet first aider? I presume so.
I'm assuming I'm a trained pet first aider.
I hope so.
Another way of saying I would hope so. I think you can do first aid courses, so it's entirely possible you could be a dog first aider. What that means you're able to do, I wouldn't definitely know. I'm not sure that you can do CPR, for example, like you would do if you were a first aider for a person. I'm very interested to find out. I will leave it with us, Lee.
Yeah. Dr. Hannah, we've run out of time. Thank you so much for your insights this afternoon. Always an absolute pleasure to catch up with you. Please send us a photo of Audrey. I'm desperate to see her. Thank you so much.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Back in 2015, when Caroline Lean broke her back, she never thought she'd be able to walk again, let alone attempt to break world records for climbing mountains or indeed lead groups on their own adventures. Doctors said the damage was so severe she was unlikely to ever walk again. She was confined to a wheelchair for months. 14 surgeries, 23 blood transfusions. She slowly regained that ability to walk, and today she's the co-founder of Life Education. It's an online platform that's been described as the Netflix of the fitness education world, and she's hopefully pulling me up all the way to the top of Kilimanjaro. We are taking a team from the physical training company with support from Gulf for Good, who are we going to be hearing from if you are inspired to do your own challenge, raising funds for a school in Tanzania. Caroline joining us now to give us a bit of an idea of what you can expect if you decide to climb the highest summit in Africa. First thing, Caroline, what am I thinking? Is it too late?
You're thinking that you are going to have the time of your life. It's going to be an amazing experience and definitely something worth doing for sure.
Well, Caroline, you are here this afternoon to explain a little bit about what you've been through and perhaps what we can expect as well. But if we could go back a step, your accident was drastic, severe, and obviously had a profound effect on your life and health. How do you feel about it now when you look back on the impact it's had?
It's bittersweet because on the one hand, I think to myself that it was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. And then at the other hand, I think I wish there was a better way to have learnt all the lessons that I learnt from that.
And when did you decide to kind of flip the story, you know, set your sights not just on climbing mountains, but breaking records as well?
When I was in Australia, it was in 2019, and I was climbing the highest mountain in Australia, and I felt amazing. I couldn't finish the climb. I was still quite disabled, and when I got 2 hours from the bottom, I actually had to call the park ranger to come and take me the rest of the way down, and my friend actually piggybacked me, and then the park ranger put us into the car and drove us the rest of the way. But I just felt amazing after that and just inspired, and I think really I just didn't want to be disabled anymore. I wanted to have a life that I could be proud of, and I just wanted to do everything that I could in order to get to that place.
Hugely inspiring what you've done so far, and that includes Kilimanjaro. Tell us about the first time you took her on.
I was very naive. I had no idea, just like most of our group, no idea what
Great.
I was getting myself into. But honestly, I made the best friends of my life on that journey, and it was kind of what sparked this love for mountains and the outdoors that I have now. It's Kilimanjaro is a really beautiful mountain, and I'm a little bit mountain superstitious. I feel like all mountains have kind of a spirit and an energy to them, and Kilimanjaro tends to do that for most people. She sparks something within them that makes them want to be mountaineers and want to go and climb the seven summits or many, many other mountains. She just wakes you up. She wakes up whatever sleeping spirit you have inside you, and she's beautiful that way. But tough, definitely very tough.
Well, so you know, nothing comes easy. You know, growth comes
exactly.
through challenge, and it's going to be a heck of a challenge. When you look back at that climb, that first time you did Killy, and again, you're coming with us next week, was there any point where you wanted to stop to say, this isn't for me, I'm going to go back down, whether that is limping or in a wheelbarrow?
No, I never had any moment where I was thinking that I wanted to turn around. I also had a very different body back then. So I found most of the hike quite easy. Summit night was definitely very tough because of the altitude and because of the cold. And I was extremely unprepared. I hired a lot of the equipment that I had. I borrowed a lot of it. I didn't really understand what any of the equipment meant. So when people were saying, you know, you need a hard shell and a soft shell and you need this type of shoe, I had no idea what those things were. So I was kind of going, okay, this I'm sure this is a soft shell and this looks like it will be a hard shell. So when I got to the mountain, I actually realized that a lot of the equipment that I had was probably inadequate, and I was very cold on the mountain, really, really cold.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
And the countdown to Kilimanjaro is on. My boots are broken in, my bag is almost packed. We're getting some expert advice about what you could expect if you sign up too.
home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're joined now by Caroline Leon. She's based here in Dubai from Australia, who has summited mountains in the UAE, Saudi, Oman, Kuwait, Turkey, Lebanon, Iran, Egypt, Jordan, and many more, thus setting a world record. It made more even more impressive by the fact that back in 2015, she fell down an outdoor rock climbing wall 7 metres, effectively breaking the right side of her body, 14 surgeries to get everything fixed and reattached, countless blood transfusions. And I'm going with her to Kilimanjaro. We're taking a team from the physical training company with support from Goal for Good, who will be hearing from raising funds for a school in Tanzania. So Caroline, can you explain a little bit about the route that we're going to be taking and what that itinerary is going to be like?
Of course. So first of all, Kilimanjaro has 7 really, really common routes that most people climb. And there's the Marengo route, and that's kind of called the Coca-Cola route. It's the only route on Kilimanjaro that has huts, and it is the most common route. Then you've got Machame, Lamesho, Shira, Rongai, the North Circuit, and Uembe. And we are going on Rongai. So it is just a standard route in the sense that we're going to be there for 7 days, going up and going down. And then hopefully all of us will be going onto the summit, which is Uhuru Peak, and that's at 5,895 metres.
Great. We are going to be talking about altitude sickness in about half an hour with Dr. Sophie from King's. What is the success rate like if we're looking at how many people actually reach that point? Caroline?
So basically, Kilimanjaro has 3 volcanic cones. There's Mwenze, Shira, and Kibo. And Kibo is the one that most people climb. And there's about 35,000 people that attempt to climb Kibo every single year. And the success rate is about 2/3 of those people summit. And the reasons that they don't summit is because of altitude sickness and other health problems. And then within that spectrum, there's also about 10 recorded fatalities a year.
So let's talk packing, because we had a bit of a kit check in the gym at the physical training company a couple of weeks ago, which basically you explaining what we need to take and going, Helen, you don't need to bring 5 pairs of trousers, but you need another long sleeve t-shirt and pack your SPF and of course the snacks. What luxuries are you going to be packing? You mentioned before that you got very cold last time on Kili.
Yeah, I did. I like to, so I'll give you all of my secrets, my mountain secrets. I like to take like a completely separate pair of pajama clothes that are always clean. Everything else is dirty and scruffy, and by day 7 you don't care, but I like to put on clean pajama clothes. So that's the first. I take a hot water bottle at night, because as you go up to camp, it starts to get colder and colder and colder. And so that actually helps me sleep. Lots of lip balm, lots of Band-Aids and stuff for the blisters and everything else. And then I take all my favorite food, like the snacks that I love to eat, the things that are going to keep me going. So I have one of my favorite snacks is like these gummy bears and jelly bellies. And some of them have like 100 calories per gummy bear.
What? Amazing.
Yeah, it's a lot.
We're not worrying about calorie burn on the climb, because we're going to be burning it all. How cold are we talking? What should I be prepared for temperature-wise?
It depends. It really depends. Sometimes you can have really good weather and it might be 0. Sometimes it might be minus 11. With wind chill, it can get up to minus 22. It just depends. It depends on the mountain, really, if she's in a good mood or a bad mood.
Well, we are going to be overpacking to make sure that Kilimanjaro is happy with us. And just for context, when we did come and do that kit check, the 3 big takeaways I got from our chat was, 1, look after your feet. 2, basically, we're all going to stink. And 3, just enjoy every single day. I think when ego gets in the way of summiting, then it's going to take everything away. I just really want to be with you guys, be in nature, enjoy every single minute. And I'm so happy that you're going to be there to spiritually and physically guide us through this, Caroline. I'm really, really, really excited/nervous. Thank you so much for your time today. And hopefully lots of people listening inspired, perhaps, if not Kilimanjaro, then to take on some kind of challenge. Caroline, I would say I'll see you soon. I'm going to see you probably on the WhatsApp group very soon because it's getting increasingly active / panicked as the countdown continues. Caroline, thank you so much for your time today. Speak to you soon.
My pleasure.
Take care. And you can follow Caroline on caroline.d.leon on Instagram to see everything she has been through and everything she is planning.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
I am on the countdown to Kilimanjaro, going with Gulf for Good on the 1st of October. And joining us now is Sean Burgess. He's Challenge Director for Gulf for Good. So if you've been feeling inspired to take on a mountain or just get training, he's telling us how. Not only is Sean involved in upcoming challenges, back in March he set off on his own epic journey, Guinness World Record quest for crossing all seven of the Emirates of the UAE in as many days on foot in a bid to support disadvantaged children in Uganda. Sean, thank you for being with us this afternoon. Can I ask you something? Do you have to be a world record attempter, holder like you or Caroline to take on a Gulf for Good challenge? Because I'm starting to feel a little bit intimidated.
Not at all. And first of all, thank you so much for having me on air and letting me talk about the incredible work that Gulf for Good does. So to settle any concerns you have straight away, mm-hmm. not at all. You don't have to be a Guinness World Record holder. We have everything for everyone at Gulf for Good if you want to get involved in the charity. We have half-day hikes all the way up to high-altitude trekking and everything in between.
So have you done Kilimanjaro? Have you ticked that off your adventure bucket list yet? And if not...
I have.
Okay, right. Please help me. I need to build some mental toughness. I think the physical side, adrenaline will kick in. You know, I might start drinking coffee. Caroline's going to be throwing gummy bears at me at every possible opportunity. But it's the mental toughness, because I've heard stories about people basically screaming into the darkness on the side of a mountain because some at night, they wake you up about 11 and then you trek through from midnight for 8 hours, which sounds like a recipe for, well, crying probably in my case. Sean, give me some tips for keeping going.
Oh, okay. So I'm not going to lie to you. That last day is pretty brutal. But what you've had before that is an amazing experience on a beautiful mountain. And also by that point, you've done so many months of training, so many months of fundraising that's what gets you through it, those last sort of 8 hours. And I promise you, when you see that sun coming up on the horizon, and it happens earlier than you think, you're reinvigorated with this new lease of life. And then it's only a couple more hours, and then you can watch the sunrise at the summit, and you climb the highest mountain in Africa. It's an amazing experience. So not going to lie to you, those few hours are tough, but that's all part of it. That's all part of the fun. That's all part of the stories when you get back. You're going to have an absolute blast with everyone that's going to do that challenge.
The kind of way I'm phrasing it in my mind is, I don't know if you have kids, but flying with a newborn, and it's about 8 hours back to the UK, and you kind of go, this is horrendous in the moment, but I know it's not forever.
Yeah,
that's my mindset. So I'm clinging on to that.
So I was going to say, you're going to be surrounded by amazing people, and Caroline especially, in the sort of things that she's done. And I know that she swears by those gummy bears. She told me the other day that that's her trick to get her to the top of mountains, is to look forward to that gummy bear, to have it, and then it gives you another couple hours worth of adrenaline up the mountain.
Bring on the bears.
Very good.
Haribo, yeah, very I am here, available as a brand ambassador. So Sean, we're going next week. It's obviously far too late to sign up for that challenge, but what's on the upcoming schedule with Gulf for Good?
Okay, so we've got so much going on over the next 12 months. The first thing that's coming up is our hiking season, which starts in a couple of weeks in October. And for anyone that's come out on these, they're such a good day. We do half days, we do full days, we do overnight trips. And because last season they were so popular, we've actually doubled the number that we're going to have this year. So we're going to do a Friday and Saturday trip.
Brilliant.
And then have these sort of one-off special ones to Bahrain and Oman. We're going to do some trips to Saudi as well as things start to open up post-COVID. And then next year, we're looking forward to the big, big challenges. So we've got Kilimanjaro again on the card, and that's an open trip.
Don't look at me.
Come on. I think that you'll get the bug and you'll want to do it again.
But do you know what? I've spent so much money on gear, Sean. I'm going to have to do another one, just get my money's worth, to be completely honest.
absolutely. And we're doing a different route as well. So you can come next year and it won't be the same trip. Mm. You'll do a different route than you're doing this year.
Let's talk in a few weeks' time. But Kilimanjaro, and what I think is really actually helpful on the site is you do kind of grade the expeditions by toughness. Some are, you know, extreme. I think Kilimanjaro is extreme. Hard, etc. And some aren't even trekking. You've done cycling challenges, kayaking challenges in the past as well. So Kili's on the cards for next year. What else is coming up for 2022?
So you're absolutely right. We do sort of grade them because we know that not everyone wants to get to the top of Kilimanjaro. Not everyone wants to do high altitude. So we've got another high altitude one that's happening, and I can't give you the actual details yet because we haven't quite launched those. We're going to do them in a couple of months, but I can give you an idea of what's going on. So we've got one more high altitude trek, and then we've got a couple that are more lower altitude but still challenging, but they're also focused a lot more on the volunteering side. Mm-hmm. So it's not just having a challenge where you're pushing yourself physically and mentally. You've also got the opportunity to spend more than a few days with the actual charity on the ground and doing the amazing work that they're doing there.
I have to say that's something that I'm really, really looking forward to. We got the schedule today for going to Enduro Primary School, which is the school that we're raising funds for. And I have to say, shout out to the Kili Crew Physical Training Company. We have more than doubled our fundraising target, over 100,000 dirhams. So thank you to everyone that's been donating and getting involved. And I think for me, that's going to be keeping me going. The thought of going and meeting the kids, and the money that we've raised is going towards completing two classrooms for those kids. And they've asked for toys to be donated, and our bags and hearts are full, and hopefully the wallet as well. So a massive thanks to that. Can I ask you a question? How do you choose the charities that Girl for Good works with? Because I know there's a big range, obviously, in terms of locations, but also causes as well.
Yeah, so it's everything that we do has to be focused. All the charities that we choose is focused on children and their sort of well-being. And it's actually quite a big process and a long process where we find these charities. It goes through our charity director, Jen, who's also the founder of Thrift for Good. If anyone's ever been to that store on the Palm, they're doing fantastic work down there. And then it goes through a sort of approval process, goes to the board. And we choose it on a load of different criteria. And they have to meet all of our core values and our mission statement as a charity. So it's not just we sort of pick one randomly from Google. It does go through this really arduous approval process. And then these partnerships that we form with these charities are not just sort of on an annual basis. We want them to be there for decades and be a part of their journey and really go back to these charities year after year. And the best example for that is Larchfields in Tanzania, which is what we partner with quite frequently for our Kilimanjaro trips. We've been able to see that journey that they've been on for the last two decades. And the charity is now celebrating its 20th year. And we can really see how our challenges and how our fundraising has really impacted that charity on the ground. So we want to do that with all of our charities that we support.
Well, I have to say, that, as I said, that is really kind of keeping me going. What about you? As I said, back in March, you set off on that journey. What's your next challenge that you're going to be taking on?
So I'm going to announce that very, very shortly. It's another UAE-based charity, challenge. I haven't quite finalized it yet, but in the next couple of weeks I will. Whether it's another Guinness World Record attempt, I'm not sure. I haven't applied for it yet, but yeah, in the next 2 or 3 months I'll be setting off for a self-supported event that's going to be about another week. But I'm not quite ready to give the details. But just recovered from the previous one. That's just
6 months recovery. Well, it's funny you mentioned world records because I was messaging the WhatsApp going, we should go for one at Kilimanjaro, like highest game of Uno or something. Because I know they've done the highest game of cricket up there. So I feel like there's an opportunity to maybe set or break a world record. And just lastly, a number of people asking for the website. Are you able to share contact details? We can have a look at that. Hiking calendar, the training schedule, and of course the upcoming challenges, Sean.
Yep, it's all on there, golfforgood.org, but also following our Instagram and our Facebook pages as well. Again, Golf for Good. You'll get all of the updates real time from us when we're going to release our challenges, which should be in the next, I'd say probably in November, we're going to release 2022 schedule, but also you'll follow the hiking sessions. And what we're also going to introduce next year is some short hot trips, because we realize that some people want to push themselves beyond the one-day hike. Some people aren't ready to commit to a 10-day high-altitude trek. So we're going to introduce three or four-night short hops to Georgia, to Armenia, into the stands, maybe to Saudi, into Jordan, and areas like that. So it gives people a real sort of breadth of choice where you can do a half day with us in Shauka Dam, or you can go and do a 10-day in Kilimanjaro or somewhere like that. So we really want to promote as much activity to our community to give them a big choice. And remember that every single bit of revenue that comes into us goes to a great cause.
Well, Sean, thank you. I know there's a huge amount of work that goes on behind the scenes to bring all of this together. So you and the team are doing a brilliant job. Thank you so, so much for your time today, your encouragement. And I'll see you on the other side.
Brilliant. Good luck.
If I come back. Sean Burgess, Challenge Director of Gulf for Good.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking about my upcoming challenge this afternoon, hopefully inspiring you to do the same. From fitness to upcoming challenges. But what about the safety side? Basically making sure you've got your first aid kit in order and all the vaccinations in your arm. Joining us live, we've got Dr. Sophie, family medical consultant at King's College Hospital, who not only is here with her doctor hat on, but as someone who has successfully summited Kilimanjaro. Dr. Sophie,
how
was it? Tell me everything, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I climbed Kilimanjaro in university so many years ago now. There's lots of things to tell you about from a doctor's perspective that I didn't really consider when I did it. So,
Now we're in 2021. I want to be throwing all of the medicine at this situation. What are some of the essential things to be taking and packing?
Okay, so first thing I'd say is make sure that you have a doctor checkup a good few months before you embark on a challenge like this. This is important in terms of vaccination, and it's good to have your vaccines done a good few months before so that you're not having any side effects just before travel. And we recommend the routine vaccinations such as MMR, tetanus, polio, influenza, and then we'll also maybe recommend some additional travel vaccines depending on your history, such as Hep A, typhoid. It's also extremely important that you're in good physical and mental health, and any long-term health conditions are under good control. Medication-wise, so Helen has been given a list of medications to pick up.
I came out of your clinic rattling, with practically a suitcase of everything from, you can take anti-malaria tablets. Obviously, mosquitoes are only below a certain altitude. They sensibly don't go any higher. The altitude sickness really is the one that so many people are asking me about. You know, how does it work? How do you take it? And if it works for everybody. So it's called Diamox. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So Diamox, or acetazolamide is the proper name for this medication. It can prevent acute mountain sickness, and it can increase the rate at which your body acclimatizes. So it works on your kidneys and can make you pass a little bit more urine as one of the side effects. It's not always suitable, so it's important to speak to your doctor whether it's okay and safe for you to take it. Can cause some side effects, so increased urine output is one of them. Tingling in your fingers and toes is another common side effect, and sometimes some dizziness. But one of the main tips for Helen would be, you know, if you're feeling unwell up the mountain, you have altitude sickness until proven otherwise. Mm-hmm. So we've gone through, you know, some of the symptoms and signs to recognise. And obviously the guides up there are very, very good at checking you every morning. I've given Helen a list of symptoms to look out for when she's up there, and there's even a special score you can do to check on yourself each day.
So as you said, the porters and guides are really good at checking in with you morning and night. What kind of questions would they ask someone who's climbing a mountain like Kilimanjaro?
I mean, the main things would be fatigue levels, headaches, if you're experiencing any, vomiting, if you are off your food, and, you know, just generally feeling fit and well to continue each day. The early symptoms of acute mountain sickness can feel just like you're tired, and, you know, maybe a little bit of headache. So it can be quite non-specific at first. So it's just about assessing yourself every day when you wake up to make sure that you're feeling okay.
And can I ask, when it comes to, you talked about kind of physical fitness, and discussed a little bit with Caroline about some of the training that we've been doing. I've heard from people who have been like, you're overtraining, it's a walk, or, you know, you'll be surprised who gets hammered by altitude sickness. It's often the people that are racing up there that are the really, really fit ones. Altitude sickness doesn't seem to discriminate at all.
No, it really doesn't. There's many stories of fit and healthy people being badly limited by symptoms of acute mountain sickness, while older people just tend to go up and feel fine. I'm not sure whether it's because young, very healthy people might go up there a little bit too quickly, and then obviously that's a risk factor if you're going up very quick. The key really is to give your body that time to acclimatise slowly. And just remember that anyone can suffer from this. It doesn't matter how old you are, what gender you are, what level of fitness you are. So if it does happen to you, then it's happening to you, and you know, you just need to do the right thing, make sure it doesn't get worse.
And Sophie, as someone, as I said, who's done Kilimanjaro, what luxury should I be packing? I'm thinking, I mean, I've got my snacks pretty much under control. I'm trying to decide if I should treat myself to a pillow or not. What do you think could make the experience... if not pleasurable, but then maybe a little bit easier?
I would say take some nice lip balm with you and some SPF, obviously, for your lips as well. But I can remember when I went up there, right at the top, I was crying and the tears were frozen to my face and my lips got really crusty. take some nice smelling lip balm.
Okay, I'm on it. Thank you so much. Expect to see me coming through the door in bits a few days after I come back to Dubai. But yeah, massively appreciate your insights, and I hope that helps anyone who is thinking about embarking. Bottom line, as you say, make sure you're getting your check well ahead. Get your bloods done. Have a chat with any specialist doctors, and don't be afraid to overpack that first aid kit, because I don't think there's a clinic on the side of that mountain. Dr. Sophie, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
No problems at all, and I'll be following you closely all the way to the top.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Not going to lie, to give you a little look behind the scenes of what it's like to work in radio, the newsroom today has been buzzing. A big, big day in news, and of course all the latest information over on ARN News Centre app. But we're talking about that relationship now between the UK and the UAE, because here's a tweet by Grant Shapps, the British Secretary of State for Transport, saying, "We will be accepting UAE vaccination certificates from the 4th of October following updates to their vaccination app. As a major transport hub, which is a home to many British expats, this is great news for reopening international travel, boosting business and reuniting families." Because joining us live on the line, we've got Nathan Taylor, product manager at Donata, live with us to talk about what this means for travel. Nathan, my phone has been going a little bit bananas today in light of this, and I can only imagine your queries at Donata have probably been on fire as well. So thank you for sparing the time to clarify some of the most common questions that we've had both on the text line and on social media too. So going to the most obvious one, which vaccines are allowed? What do we know about that approved vaccination certificate into the UK from the UAE?
Yeah, so hi Helen, it's awesome to speak to you again, and obviously, you know, great to speak about such amazing news coming out today. In terms of the vaccines that are accepted under the new program, so from the 4th of October, Oxford, AstraZeneca, the Pfizer vaccine, Moderna and Johnson & Johnson are all on the list of accepted vaccines for the UK.
And does that mean a full course, so double vaccinated out of the UAE?
Absolutely, yeah. So making sure that, you know, you're fully vaccinated and that you've had both doses at least 14 days before entering into England are part of the application. Yeah.
And I'm sure Sinopharm, those who've had it will be, well, perhaps booking in for their Pfizer booster and the follow-up as well. And I think a lot of people did get that Pfizer second dose for exactly this reason, you know, to kind of tick that paperwork box if and when this announcement was made. I'm just curious a little bit to get more of an understanding of what else you need to do or to prepare before you head to England. And we should be very clear in saying it is England right now. The rest of the United Kingdom has not been yet clarified. So what else? You're talking about 14 days before you arrive in England. What about the paperwork, Nathan?
Yeah, so there's still a little bit of paperwork to do, not as much, but all travellers who do qualify as fully vaccinated going into England do have to book and pay for their day two COVID-19 test on arrival in England, and they also have to complete a passenger locator form. So those are the two main bits of paperwork that still need to be completed. It does mean, though, that you know, there's no more need for, you know, quarantining or isolating in a hotel for 10 days. There's no more need for the day 8 test or any sort of test to release scheme. So it is a lot more simplified now, and it's excellent news.
It's simplified and a lot kinder on the bank balance as well. When I was, my goodness, yeah. I was booking tests. My mum, when she was over to Quebec, I was like, crikey, this is steep. So yeah. I'm curious, though, what impact do you think this is going to have on prices of air tickets, though? Could we be having to pay more now that it's going to be easier?
Well, look, I don't want to speculate too much on the prices. All I know is that the airlines have absolutely responded to meet the demand. So, you know, all of our key airline partners here in the UAE, you know, have increased capacity going to the UK. So I'm sure that, you know, everybody will be able to get over there very, very soon.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We have seen some big announcements today. We've been talking about that mask rule soon. And right now, the UAE has said we will be accepting UAE vaccination certificates from 4th of October following updates to the vaccination app. So reuniting families, as they say, boosting business and reopening international travel. So to tell us more about that UK announcement, Nathan Taylor's joining us. He's a product manager at Donata. Talking about what it means for travel, what it means for paperwork, prices and logistics as well. Melissa's been in touch on 4001, Nathan, saying, what is the process for those who've had Sinopharm, please, no intention to take Pfizer 2? So you're able to recap perhaps what it was previously, or indeed if someone has had Sinopharm, what they would need to do, paperwork, etc., to get into the UK at the moment.
Yeah, so at the moment, the approved vaccines are, like I said before, the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. If there are any changes to that or any updates, definitely we will, you know, we'll be the first to have that, and we will put that on donatatravel.com. But at this stage, those are the vaccines that are accepted. If you don't fall into those categories, then the old rules do apply. So, you know, there's still that 10-day isolation with the tests on day 2 and day 8 with the test to release scheme as well if you're going into England.
And a question here from Jamie saying, what about the kids? So in terms of vaccinated children or most likely unvaccinated children, if parents have been vaccinated with, let's say, Pfizer, but you've got children who haven't been vaccinated, what do they need to do in terms of quarantine?
Yeah, so based on the update that we've got from gov.uk, if a passenger is under 18, as long as they're a resident of the UK or the UAE, they'll just need to go through the same process as their parents. So, you know, making sure they've got that day 2 COVID-19 test booked, they filled out the passenger locator form, and then they're good to go. But what I would suggest, you know, if you do have more specific questions, particularly around, you know, travelling as a family, contact the Donata Travel Experts on 800 Donata or visit us in store. They will have all of the up-to-date information, you know, for your specific travel.
And let's just be super clear, we're talking about England because these rules currently are not clarified for the rest of the UK. Now, Nathan, I can't have you on the line and not ask you about some deals. I know the half term is fast approaching. Any travel offers based in the UK that we should be aware of?
Yeah, we've got absolutely heaps, but I'll just give you one to close out. So we've got 3 nights at the Copthorne Tara Hotel, which is in Kensington.
Sorry to interrupt. That's my mum used to work at that hotel.
Did she?
Yeah, when she was 19 years old, she worked at the Tara. She was a receptionist. Oh, that is so spooky. So
there you go.
Oh, I should tell her to meet me there. So the Copthorne Tara, as you say, in Kensington. What's the deal? And does it include flights?
Yes. So we've got breakfast daily there, return economy class flights with Emirates, and that's coming in at 3,185 dirhams per person. And if you want to take the kids, it's 2,715 per child as long as they're under 12.
So just to recap, economy flights, 3 nights at Babs's Hotel, the Tara. She still talks about it, including breakfast. 3,185 for adults. Thank you, Nathan. Really, really helpful. As you say, lots of information over on donatatravel.com. Latest announcements over on the ARN News Centre app as well. I'm sure you've got a busy afternoon ahead dealing with the many inquiries for half term coming up, but really appreciate your time this afternoon offering some clarity.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's been a big day of news, hasn't it? And the countdown of Expo 2020 is, of course, on. But it's also World Zero Emissions Day today as well. And I've got the perfect guest with us joining now who's involved in both. Carl Fielder is a Dubai-based clean tech entrepreneur and founder of Neutral Fuels. So what this means is Neutral Fuels has produced, wait for it, 13.5 million litres of biofuel. That's replacing diesel and, well, I can't even begin to say the number, 36 million plus CO2 EQ in commission since inception, and it started up that facility in Abu Dhabi. Incredible achievement, Cole. Thank you for being with us today. For anyone who's not familiar with the concept of zero emissions, can you explain a little bit of it in perhaps not too scientific terms for us?
Oh, thanks, Helen. And what a great introduction. Thank you very much. We essentially take the waste from the kitchens and the restaurants of the UAE. And in our two factories in the UAE, we convert that into a biofuel, which is a complete replacement for diesel. So you can use it up to 100% in your engine without any modifications. And because it's made from waste, it's extremely green. There is a little bit of carbon footprint left over because we have to buy some other chemicals in order to convert it into biofuel. And those chemicals, we calculate the emissions and we plant trees to immediately offset it. So our customers that are using a pure biofuel have no carbon footprint in their transport.
Can we go back to, you said zero modifications. So let's say in an ideal world, I'm sure the petrol station around the corner from my house will one day have a neutral fuel nozzle, and I could stick it, I could put it in my Kia without worrying about it going putter, 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 stop down the road.
Well, no, actually, if you put it in your Kia, it wouldn't work at all because it works with diesel, not petrol.
So it's purely diesel conversion. Okay,
This is a diesel, but all the trucks and school buses all run on diesel.
I'll tell my dad, he's got a Land Rover at home, you need to get shipping over to Northumberland. But now, this is really key, especially with Expo 2020, very close on the horizon. You're involved in that sustainability scheme where they're going to be using that cooking oil from restaurants on site. Is that right?
That's true. We've deployed about 100 of our special oil containers onto the expo site in all the pavilions, and we're going to be converting that into biofuel, which is then going to be used by the same trucks that go in at night and collect all the rubbish. So it's what we call a closed loop system. So it takes the waste as an input and also uses the output fuel to run those trucks. But we've been involved with Expo since, well, before it started. I remember getting a really strange phone call, must have been 3 or 4 years ago, that one of our delivery tankers was at the Expo site 3-4 years ago, and it was buried up to its axles because there was no roads. So we've been involved in helping construct even the roads and the buildings. And we've been doing that all along, and we've been using the waste from the UAE in order to help the construction of Expo, to make it the most sustainable Expo ever.
Must be hugely exciting for you to see everything that's coming together with, well, in single digits now. What are you most looking forward to?
A bit of peace and quiet. I haven't had any peace and quiet for ages. During COVID, we went from one factory to four factories. We've got two in the UAE, one in India, and one in Bahrain. And by the end of this year, we're going to be 8 factories. And it's absolutely bonkers busy. Honestly, I've never known anything like it in my life.
No, but that's brilliant that there's more of an appetite and more of an understanding of the impact that, you know, obviously big companies and governments can have, but also perhaps us as individuals as well. And I'm curious, you know, so many of us are completely clueless about how to reduce our carbon footprint, and I definitely include myself in that. Carl, as an industry insider and someone who leads a pretty sustainable life yourself as an individual, as well as obviously the work you do with Neutral Fuels, what are some of the things that we might be doing on a daily or annual basis that we perhaps don't realise are having an impact?
Well, unfortunately, it's not the answer that you would like, but the answer is most of us have somebody in the family who works for a living. The most important thing that any of us can do is to get that person who's employed to ask his employer their employer.
Thank you.
I mean, basically, the question is, when is this company going to have a net zero strategy? Mm. How can I help them implement net zero? And what's the date of delivering of it? Because COP26 is coming up in Glasgow later on this year, when all the world's governments are going to get together. A lot of hot air is going to be talked, and they're going to talk about when each of the countries is going to get to net zero. But the countries themselves can't get there unless the businesses get there. And all the businesses need a net zero strategy.
Can I ask you, when you look internationally then, are there any companies that are absolutely smashing it, that are leading the way and full of good ideas and innovation?
There are. I mean, we work with IKEA, Nestle, McDonald's. They've all got really, really good, well-defined goals. They know exactly where they're going. They're spending the time and the money and the effort on implementing the things. And these are leading brands, and they know that they have to do it, not just because their consumers are demanding it, but because it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing increasingly now, is that businesses are looking at, yeah, we've got to make profit, but also how are we going to be long-term sustainable in the eyes of our customers and in the eyes of our shareholders?
And not be on the wrong side of history. And the time to act is now. And as you said, so much happening in terms of sustainability at Expo 2020. It's going to be a real source of inspiration for an awful lot of visitors. Carl, for anyone who is looking to petition their employers or find out more about what you're doing, more information can be found where, sir?
www.neutralfuels.com, or look for us on Facebook or Twitter or anywhere that's got a social media, anything. You'll find us all over the place.
Good man. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it. Is it weird to say Happy World Zero Emissions Day? Is that a thing?
I just wish everybody was at zero emissions.
Well, hopefully in years to come, we'll have a chat and we'll look back at this day, September 22nd. Go, do you remember? I had a dream, and hopefully one day it's going to come true. Carfield, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are marking this afternoon World Zero Emissions Day. And to be honest with you, something I don't know a huge amount about, but we're bringing in the expert, speaking earlier to Carl Fielder of Neutral Fuels, who turns literally cooking oil into a diesel replacement. And electric vehicles. Do you drive one? Let us know. Do you love it? We love a recommendation. Kevin Shaloub joining us this afternoon, founder of EV Lab. It's a store that sells exactly that, electric vehicles. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us. You've been really active trying to educate people about driving EVs. Tell us a little bit about the pickup rate. Have you seen an increase in the number of EV drivers in recent years?
Thanks, Helen. The UAE market has increased year on year during COVID by actually 72%, which
wow.
is really exciting. It's still low in market share. It's still 1% of total vehicles sold, lower than most markets. But we do expect it to rise, especially with the venue of Expo and the incentives that the government has put in place, such as free charging, free parking.
When we're talking about electric vehicles, are you talking exclusively about cars, or are we bringing scooters and bikes in there as well?
These numbers are specifically about cars. Now, our concept, we are planning to launch a store with scooters and all electric mobility solutions.
Can I ask you one favor when you do that? Can you please yeah. insist that people wear a helmet and drive sensibly, because they are driving me up the wall. Now you're saying there, massive increase, 72% pickup of late. But what do you think is stopping, someone like me, for example, mum of two working, what's stopping me from switching, do you think?
Sure. I mean, we've had a lot of early adopters come in and people that are really excited about technology, about cars, about Tesla a lot, as they are the brand that has sold the most. Now, there are other options in the market. Now that range is getting better and better and really in the market like the UAE, you don't really need to go too far compared to Europe or the US. Abu Dhabi or Oman would be the longest distance. Most vehicles in the market do allow you to do that range, and performance is better, and more importantly, these are products that are better for the environment. We do expect more and more people to get interested for those reasons.
Kevin, can we talk cash? Can I ask you the initial purchase cost, but also cost of maintenance and cost of running as well? How do they stack up?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, electric vehicles, there are electric vehicles for everyone. There are different types. Charging stations are free. Public chargers from Diwa are completely free. So you don't need to even compare that to going to a gas station. There are much less spare parts in electric vehicles. So actually maintenance is much less. So you don't need to do your oil change or send it to the dealer for such long amount of of times and so often. So overall, it's really a benefit to own an electric car. Now, some products are still more expensive than their combustion engine equivalent, but over the life cycle of your vehicle, you should be saving quite a bit.
Okay, now time to maybe make us put our hands in our wallets and spend our hard-earned dirhams on an EV. What are some of the hottest models out there? What's got you excited as a driver and as someone who's interested in the industry as well?
Yeah, I mean, the Porsche Taycan, the Audi e-tron GT have come out.
Can we come back to the Porsche? Because that was announced quite some time ago and the waiting list was crazy. No chance of getting one unless you were not just an early adopter, like on some kind of secret WhatsApp group. What's availability like?
I do suspect pretty low. Also, during the industry suffering a bit of supply chain shortages due to COVID. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a good problem to have. You know, these are desirable products. We need to wait for them, pre-order them now, there's a lot of options available. I have to say the Chevy Bolt EUV that's coming out is also really exciting with 572 kilometers in range. Mercedes coming out with the EQS, which is going to be the longest range in the market with up to 700 kilometers. So very, very exciting products coming.
Kevin, what do you drive yourself? Please don't say some kind of muscle car. Just undermine the last 10 minutes.
I drive the Audi e-tron SUV, nice. which is really comfortable. And I used to have the Tesla Model 3. Before that, I had a plug-in hybrid, but do really prefer the electric cars.
Well, it's going to be hugely interesting to see how this develops, certainly over the next 6 months, because you are going to be at Expo 2020. Kevin, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. And you can find Kevin Chaloup at EV Lab and, as I said, at Expo 2020.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.